Ladies and gentlemen, if I can have your attention just for several moments. Welcome to the FCC. Very nice to have you here. Let me just give you the normal warning. If you leave your telephone on during this session, you will have to read the club's rules and regulations 5 times without a stop. If you don't do that, let me just remind you before I introduce our speaker today that we have an exceedingly full program in the coming weeks. We have on the 25th, Kumi Naido speaking on Can China and the Basic Countries, that lovely new world, save the climate. On the 28th, we have Michael Palin, and if you're thinking of booking now, don't bother. There's a waiting list very, very long. And on the 1st of June, we have Jerome Cohen talking about how to improve China's soft power and America's. And there's many other events, but I'm not going to bore you with all of that now. Our topic today, as you know, is entitled Thailand's Withdrawal Symptoms, Democracy and Monarchy in Transition. I think it's fair to say that in this club, there are many, many people who have a profound interest in Thailand. And there are an equal number of people who are exceedingly confused and uncertain about what is happening in Thailand at the moment. So in that context, we're extremely fortunate to have as a speaker today Thitinan Pongsudhirak, who is, I was trying to force out of him a partiality for either side of the conflict, and he assures me that although people try and ascribe a position to him, that is not a correct point of view. He's somebody who is a considerable expert on these matters. He's teaching at Chulalongkorn University and is also has been a visiting scholar at Stanford recently. But most importantly, I hope he is somebody who can guide us through this exceedingly complex situation which is playing itself out on the streets of Bangkok at the moment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen. And hello, everyone. Good afternoon. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here to speak. And I want to also note that this is a great building and a great facility for a Foreign Correspondents Club. I'll have to go back and tell the FCCT, the Foreign Correspondents people in Bangkok, that they need to do better. This is a short talk. 20 minutes cannot say very much for a crisis that has been around, ongoing for 5-6 years. So I have just 3 main points to make. I think I will try to give you a sense of the genesis of this crisis, and then to speak a little about the current dynamics, and then to wrap up on the point of all of this being seen or could be seen as symptoms of a withdrawal. And that is really not my original term. It comes from a famous scholar, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. So first, the genesis of the crisis is a slippery, murky point. Conventionally, people think that Thaksin is the cause of this crisis in Thailand. That somehow Thailand was a great R&R place for the foreign correspondents in Hong Kong until Thaksin came along and he did something to Thailand that has not made it viable and workable. To some extent, that is true. That is true. I think that someone like Thaksin was bound to come along, but he is a consummate politician with skills and qualifications, networks of people and ambition, capacity, wealth, that is unrivaled. So he is a unique person to come along. At the same time, I also think that the historical forces at work also underpin the rise of Thaksin. If you want to look at the origins of this crisis, you can put your fingers on many things. So you could say that Thaksin came in, he monopolized Thai politics. His Thai Rak Thai Party from 1998-2001 won the election, took over small parties, became a juggernaut in Thai politics, marginalizing civil society, dismissing the opposition, having a unassailable control of the legislature, engaging in conflicts of interest, abuse of power, human rights violations, the war on drugs killed extrajudicially 2,275 people in 2003, 2004. Thaksin had a business conglomerate that benefited from his time in office. There were many conflicts of interest, his cronies, his associates, his underlings, his family members and children all had stakes in the Thai economy during his time in power. That is part of the story. I mean, Thaksin has something to do with it. But some people could say that, well, how then did this one man and the Thairak Thai Party became so invincible? Some would say that Thailand had a structural disparity, that there were a lot of poor people in the countryside that Thaksin was able to tap into. And when you want to win elections in Thailand, 55% of the vote resides in the north and northeast. And Thaksin and Thairak Thai systematically went out to see what kinds of policies that would cater to those people. And they came up with a policy platform, the populist policy platform that we know about. Cheap healthcare, microcredit schemes, OTOP, you know, they're selling the village handicrafts in world markets, debt suspension for farmers. He reorganized the bureaucracy, had industrial upgrading plans. I think above all, it's not just the specifics of the policy platform as much as the idea behind the platform, the idea that Thailand needed to move forward and that things had to be done differently. Thaksin and Thairak Thai were elected and then re-elected in a landslide in 2005. So without that structural disparity, he could not have exploited the electoral landscape to such great success. So you can say Thaksin, you can say the structure of Thai economy, the structure of the Thai socio-political hierarchy that made it possible for Thaksin to rise. So my point is that the genesis of this crisis, it's not just Thaksin. Yes, Thaksin had a lot to do with it. It's not just about the structure of Thai society, even though that was conducive for someone like Thaksin to rise. But it was more about a evolving hierarchy that had inherent contradictions. In the end, I see Thaksin as someone who delivered a new Thailand, and that new Thailand is being contested. It may not be a pleasant one, but he broke up the system that had been in place, the consensus that had prevailed, that consensus based on the axis of the inner workings of the bureaucracy, the monarchy, the military. Thaksin came in and through his monopolization upended this consensus no longer could the bureaucrats run Thailand, or the military had its own way, and in the process propping up the monarchy. So here is where I think we could understand Thailand's transformation. I think that it is a transformation from a monarchy-centered socio-political hierarchy to a more people-centered democratic development. And that's why I included both the monarchy and democracy in the title. If you want to understand what's happening to Thailand, you need to understand a bit about Thai democracy, but you have to look also at how monarchies in the world adapt and change and reform, or not adapt and change and reform. So that's the first point. The genesis is not easy to pinpoint. Many factors involved. You could even be a historian and say that this is 100 years of crisis. Thailand had a similar crisis like this in the 1910s, 1920s, and that led eventually to the replacement of absolute monarchy with constitutional monarchy. My second point now is about the current events. It's convoluted, very murky, and I think that most people don't can't keep up or are confused, or and many people in Thailand are. On the one hand, you have the red shirts now protesting in the middle of Bangkok, shutting down the central business district, and it's very depressing in Thailand. It affects livelihoods, and for me personally, I work in the area, so the crisis is in the air, and it's stressful for everybody in Bangkok. Beyond Bangkok, not so stressful. Stressful in different ways. In Bangkok, it's more of an annoyance and hassle, a nuisance. But outside Bangkok, very different. And we can talk about that in the Q&A. So now you have the opposite government holding on to power. You have the red shirts protesting. And the latest, before I came, you know, they've had this round series of brinkmanship. And the latest brinkmanship is that the government must surrender, the Deputy Prime Minister Suthep must surrender himself to police to be charged for killing people, for the casualties and fatalities that occurred on April 10th when the soldiers shot at civilians. The government thinks that the civilians, the red shirts, have armed elements, terrorists, quote-unquote, among them, and that they're the ones who killed the soldiers. So, you know, this is kind of tit-for-tat, and it's a long, long story. It goes back to, you know, 2005, 2006, the military coup, the coup government, the new constitution under military supervision, elections in 2007, the pro-red government, the red shirts party won, pro-red governments in 2008 overthrown, being overthrown in the streets by the yellow airport shutdown. And then now you have the opposite direction. The opposing side, opposite, is in power. So the red shirts have been protesting since early 2009. In April 2009, they protested in Bangkok and degenerated into riots and violence. But in less than a year, they're back. They're back. And it's not surprising that they're back. They're back in Bangkok protesting after Thaksin's assets confiscation. So it has to do with Thaksin still. But at the same time, they were bound to come and protest in Bangkok again, because what has happened to them is that their party has been dissolved not once, but twice. So Thai Rak Thai was dissolved, and then the Thai Rak Thai successor party was overthrown in the streets indirectly, and then dissolved again in December 2008. So they've been disenfranchised, these red shirt people, and they, because they don't feel part of the system, they're disillusioned with the system. And there's now, I think, another state within the Thai state. I mean, the red shirts have their own country in the northeast. Even in Bangkok, their encampment is, they have their own music, their own paraphernalia, they have their own food. All the logistics, and you can go and visit yourself. I don't recommend that in the near term, but you can get photos or something. But it's really a city within Bangkok, and then they have their own state in the northeast where Apisit cannot visit. He can visit, but you know, he'll be people will throw things at him. People have issued death threats on his life, his family's life, and so you have another way to think about Thailand's transformation. What is considered Thailand and Thai and Thai-ness? Thai-ness, the Thai identity, such as it is and as it has been in the last 60 years, is coming loose at the seams, right? The consensus no longer there, and a new consensus has not been formed. So when you have Thai-ness, Thai identity, the constitution of what is known as Thailand and the Thai-ness, being shaken to its foundations, you have, as a result, you know, an uncontrollable insurgency in the south, Malay Muslim insurgency. You have a rebellion, insurrection in the northeast, in the north, So the center, when a center has been weakened and is weakening, the peripheries are running amok. And now I think it's going to be very difficult. And part of my mission is to try to find a way to return to some kind of a new settlement, new equilibrium and consensus. But that will take a lot of changes. So the second point is that now, the current dynamics, brinkmanship, and what will happen this time, there could be violence, there could be a crackdown, but we will pass this phase. We will pass this phase. But it will build up to a more violent and volatile phase down the road. If the election doesn't take place in November like the Apisit has pledged, the red shirts will come back. And I don't think the election will take place. I mean, I would be surprised just because the Prime Minister has said November 14th. It's not really his prerogative to set the election date. He can only dissolve the House. But nevertheless, he has come up with a concrete date. Many things can happen to derail this election timetable. And equally, many things must happen to hold it in place. So if the Yellows don't go for it, if Apisit doesn't survive in the premiership, if the coalition parties defect, all kinds of things can happen. And this one thing, just the one change, can derail the election timetable. In the meantime, you have to have many things. All things must be in place in order for it to take place on November 14th. So I'm not very hopeful. I hope that we will find a way forward, a way out in the immediate term, but not a way forward. But that doesn't look promising for this year. So more confrontation, more turmoil, greater likelihood of violence, and election would not really resolve this crisis. You would end up with the likelihood of the Red Shirt Party winning. And then you go back to 2008, right? You basically now have a majority and a minority that is very distinctive. Majority wins elections, they get kicked out, and then they come back to protest against the minority-led government, minority-supported government. So somehow, at the end of the day, there has to be a compromise, a consensus on majority rule with minority safeguards. The minority, the PAD, the Apisit backers, the patrons of Apisit and the establishment, they're afraid of the Thaksin period, right, where you have a majority rule, but it became kind of like a blank check for abuse and corruption and so on. At the same time, you cannot deny majority rule. You can change the constitution to come up with a new one, but they still win the election. And this is something that is, I think, new for Thailand, for the rulers of Thailand. The pressures of democratization, globalization, have changed the landscape. They cannot avoid it. If they do, it would be at a very high cost. And that's the Thai dilemma in amidst the current dynamics. Now I come to my last point. How can we encapsulate and frame these confusing, convoluted events that are exhausting to follow and stressful to be around? In 1976, in October 1976, Thailand had one of its watershed political events. There was a suppression of student activists, a lot of violence, and so on. Shortly after, a famous, world-famous professor, and he is known for his work on nationalism, and you must know the book called Imagine Communities. Ben Anderson, in 1977 wrote an article, which I think is probably the best article in 40 years of Thai politics, called Withdrawal Symptoms. But this article actually described October 1976 as a right-wing backlash suppression of an emerging challenger from a new aspirations, left-leaning communist in some ways. And it was a successful suppression because it was the Cold War. They had a certain consensus on fighting the Cold War. They wanted to keep away communism. And the students were basically crushed. And a lot of them died. at that time, very polarized like now, very polarized. The right-wing backlash was rabid and severe, violent. This time you see similar passions in Thailand, and one of the questions I think about a lot is what makes a person yellow or red or whatever color in Thailand? And this is a deep-seated emotion. Some people, you know, very difficult to generalize. Some people you would not think of them being yellow. They turn out to be yellow. Typically, a yellow person would be Bangkok-based, you know, with a stake in the status quo, pro-status quo, anti-toxin, anti-corruption, pro-monarchy, sympathetic to the military, PAD, you know, this yellow middle class with upward mobility, right, a stake in the system. And typically a red would be someone who has been alienated outside the system, just lots of nobodies. They don't have upward mobility, and their children will not have upward mobility. They don't go to the best schools. To go to have upward mobility, you have to go to the good schools, and they're all in Bangkok. You have to come to Bangkok somehow. So this really is deep-seated. Well, in 76, the backlash was so rabid and visceral that it was described as a withdrawal. You know, when you are used to, you're accustomed to the way that things are. When they are challenged, when they change, when they are taken away or eclipsed somehow, there's a lot of resistance. There's a lot of resistance. And the resistance can be severe, can be violent. And that's what I think we're seeing in Thailand. Thailand, as we know it, is coming to an end. It's not the end of Thailand, of course, but as we know it in the last 60 years, it's coming to an end. There's a the status quo is untenable. We all hope for a peaceful transition and workable transformation so that we can get to a point where Thailand can move forward again. But we're a long way from that. During this transformation, there's a lot of emotions, passions, and the polarization is deep-seated, and understandably, many people have stakes in it. So I think that what we're seeing and have seen in the last 5-6 years is an outcome of the last 10 years and the last 50-60 years. Development in Thailand has been concentrated in Bangkok. It has not been really filtered into the rest of the country, not sufficiently anyway. So you now have these voices who have been neglected and ignored awakened, and things have changed. You know, the cat's out of the bag. The lid is open now, and you cannot put it back on. So they will not be denied. They'll vote for parties. You dissolve them, but they'll come and protest, and they'll protest again until they get their voices heard. At the same time, you can imagine the other side, very paranoid now, the establishment behind Apisit, fearful of the future. They think that this is the end, what a challenge to the status quo, but possibly the subversion of the established order to create a new Thai socio-political order based on allegedly Thaksin, red shirts, you know. But these are the symptoms of a challenged order that is giving way without a clear destination, without a clear alternative. And if you put the yellows, the protest, the airport, the military coup, after Thaksin, then you can kind of see that this is really a expressions of revolt, of dissatisfaction with the challenges to the existing established order. And I think we'll see many more colors and many more episodes of this. We're seeing it now, and we'll see more violent and volatile events in the coming months until we can reach a point that a compromise, a consensus can be formed. And then at that point, then Thailand can maybe move forward again. But much is a long road, and much has to take place. The signals and the signs are not very promising to me the kinds of changes and reforms that are imperative are not being broached and in fact are being resisted to the contrary, meaning that, you know, no matter what happens, Thailand has to be the same. But the underpinning, the basis of this withdrawal symptoms article, not mine, Ben Anderson's, is that you have, you know, social formation over time generates political change. And in this case, you see a lot of new voices that are trying to be heard. And it's a different kind of Thai society that has been built on a long economic boom, which elicits a new kind of political order that has to correspond with the socioeconomic changes that have been that have taken place. So a long way from that point. In the meantime, I think we just have to brace ourselves for a very topsy-turvy period during this withdrawal, and we can hope that the withdrawal will be overcome and that they could reach a new state of being in Thailand. Thank you.
That did exactly what it says on the label, helped us to understand where we are now. The usual thing, if you'd like to ask a question, please indicate and say your affiliation if you have such a thing. Mark, over here. At the back. No. Maybe you can come forward a bit, Mark. Oh. Yeah.
For the Russian business magazine expert, thank you very much for a great speech. I just wanted to ask you, in your speech you never mentioned one person who is very influential in Thailand, and I know it's a sensitive issue for a Thai citizen, but like what is your take of the king's role in the current events, and what will be the because we are we'll see probably a transition of power in some years. So what will be the role of monarchy in this new order that you are kind of foreseeing in the future? Thank you.
Okay, I have not been specific about this. It's in the title and I alluded to it. I talked about the established order, the axis of bureaucracy, military, and monarchy, the way things that have been in Thailand, and that the end of Thailand is, as we know it, is with us. You know, it would be, I think, disingenuous for anyone to talk about Thailand in any informed way these days without discussing the role of the monarchy. And it is a sensitive and delicate issue because people have gone to jail for that. There is a strict lèse majesté law which has a geographic coverage. I mean, you can go speak somewhere else outside Thailand, but you can return to Thailand into trouble. So with that caveat, I'll say what I can. And I think that sometimes the facts speak for themselves, right? Many people have been looking to His Majesty the King to say something or find a way out of this crisis. And we've seen this before in May 1992, on May 20th, 1992, after 3 days of shootings in the streets, dozens of fatalities, the King came out and the two main protagonists prostrated, crawled to the King and sort of settle the differences, and Thailand was able to move on. This time, it has not happened. And it's also a fact that you can, it is public information that His Majesty has not been well, has been in hospitalized for some months now. In the past, has had spinal surgery, heart difficulties. So the physically, many ailments over the years. This time, there has not been a quote-unquote royal intervention because the balance has not tipped, and it's very delicate for anyone to intervene. And if you don't intervene on the right side or in the right way with the right balance, it's at a great risk. So that means that if you say something, it doesn't happen. If His Majesty says something, it doesn't happen. It also would erode his own moral authority. So I think it's just too much at stake now. And I think that it's not what it used to be. This time, it's not a clear-cut kind of pro-democracy uprising against a military dictatorship. You know, between a military dictatorship and the people power, you can choose the people power. But now it's people power and it's people power, different times. And too much at stake now, I think, for His Majesty to intervene, and not to mention the physical constraints. And I think behind the scenes, and this gets very delicate, there are many movements and maneuverings, which I can tell you in person, maybe.
Daisanne McLean from National Geographic. I want to thank you for coming and just say that I know that there are many, many people in this room that care very much about Thailand and that hope very, very much that you're able to resolve this situation. My question is not about the monarchy. I was in Thailand last week and I did what you don't recommend that we do, which is I went to the Red Shirt City. Actually, Ernst was there. Also, it's very easy to get to. You just take the SkyTrain and get off. It is, as you described, it's very much a city within a city. But when you walk around, the first thing you notice is that it's not exactly as it has been portrayed up to now in the foreign press, which has portrayed the Red Shirts as a movement of the underclass and has implied that it has some kind of coherency and ideological basis, you know, the rich, the poor versus the rich and so forth and so on. What I saw in the camp, however, was a very, a rather fragmented community. Towards the middle, you do have people who are obviously rice farmers and they were camped out on the street. But if you move toward the perimeters where the barricades are, there was actually a kind of very worrisome paramilitary force of young guys. Some of them had been drinking a lot. They were wearing black rather than red. They were hopped up. And although I didn't see any weapons, they clearly were a kind of paramilitary force ready to roll. I want to get your take on just what the UDD is, because it seems to be a very non-ideological party to me, which is the most worrisome thing about it, and particularly the factions within it. What exactly, who are the leadership? Is there really a leadership, or are they at cross purposes to each other? One of them seems to have been disappeared in the last few days. Another one is an old Marxist. Then there's Sedang, who is the leader of this paramilitary.
Daisy, I'm going to just cut you off. Yeah. I think we got the question.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. I'm a little inside baseball. No, it's a perceptive question. The UDD, and this is the United Front for Democracy Against Dictatorship, UDD, is the arch nemesis of the PAD. And the leadership is fragmented, yes, and they have an armed wing, and they have guards. You have to understand them as a social movement. This is a social movement. It's not static. It evolves. It's very dynamic. So over the past 2 months alone, they have evolved. You have to look at the PAD, you know, in 2008. It's also a social movement then. They had their main backers, their foot soldiers, and interestingly, both movements, the bulk of them in the center are women. You go to the red stage at the high point, the prime time is about 11 p.m., midnight, and the center is almost all women, many, many women, and the PAD was the same. So this is very complex, and it needs a thorough examination. But for your question, yes, it's a social movement. It has an arm, the wing, they have guards, and I think that they learned from last year. They will do some defending themselves, and you know they also have another black-clad, unknown black-clad professionals who retaliated or shot at soldiers on April 10th. We don't know if they're affiliated with the Reds or not, but we assume that they're pro-Red because they shot at the soldiers. So leadership is fragmented. What is happening is UDD and red shirts are not synonymous, right? Red shirts and Thaksin, not synonymous. UDD and Thaksin, not synonymous. So over time, these red shirts, they take on a life of their own. It becomes an organic movement. And the way to do it, you have to go to the Northeast. You go to Ubon Rajatani, Konkan, you can see that they have their own fundraising, mobilization, organization, leaders at the grassroots. They have UDD schools to educate people about injustice and political history and all of that. It's a social movement, I think, that is coming into its own. And that is alarming. Trend because you know the worst case scenario, not so much the worst case, but one logical outcome would be that they turn into a revolutionary movement if they're not accommodated somehow, if they're alienated and dismissed, right? So yes, they have less under Thaksin, but still affiliated with Thaksin, tied up with Thaksin, UDD and Thaksin leadership, UDD leadership and Thaksin, but the red shirts, foot soldiers. This is something that we need to pay close attention to. They don't have alternative leadership. A lot of the potential leadership for them, that could find a third way, a way out of this crisis. It has been banned from politics, right? Because of the party dissolution in 2008 2007. So this is the dilemma. The foot soldiers, the grassroots have genuine legitimate grievances. They've been disenfranchised. But they don't have any other leadership except the UDD leaders who are still somewhat paid by Thaksin and others, and one left, and they're fragmented, and they also don't agree. That's why they're still protesting today. Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much for your insight. My name is Todd Everts, and I'm not a journalist, but I work for a company called Wall Street Global. I read recently that there is a undeclared civil war going on in Thailand. I work in Hong Kong, but I live my weekends in Thailand between Bangkok and the Northeast. And I have a home in both places. And I just don't see it. I just don't see the conflict. I see paid people to protest by some faction. But the people that I see in Korat and Khao Yai, which is where I am, they don't have any of these cares that you're talking about. The people that I see in Bangkok, supposedly these yellow shirts, I don't see it. Can you convince me that this problem is as real as it's exposed to be?
Okay. Well, first, I'm touched that Thailand is such a special country for many, many people that I've run across in the world. I don't think that Thailand as a country has enemies. I mean, people like Thailand, and we're all touched by that. Now, there's a little bit of bad news for you guys because, I think that there's a kind of a complacency hang up with, Thailand is a great place to visit. It's a great place to visit. And I think that there's also a little bit of a withdrawal among the expats, foreign residents in Thailand, frequent visitors to Thailand, because of this crisis is protracted, and it's no longer the Thailand that used to be an easy place to visit and go to the beach and mountains, and it's a Thailand whose airport has been closed for 8 days, right? So I understand where your question emanates from, and there is this view that I think that. There's nothing wrong here. There's no polarization. There's no tensions. I mean, the Thai farmers, comparatively in the developing world, the Thai agricultural sector,
and the Thai economy have grown robustly, more than most. So in fact, the farmers should be pretty happy. I mean, their lot has improved over the years. Their lot has improved over the years. There is no starvation. People have food to eat. But I think, as you see in the months to come, I suspect you will see a prolonged confrontation. And after a while, you have to ask yourself, well, are these people really paid to come? I mean, you know, and I think if you have a mob of 1,000, 3,000, 5,000, you can rent a mob for 1,000 people. It's about 300 baht, 400 baht a day. You can do it for about, you know, a week, 2 weeks, logistically. But when you come like this for 2 months, or in the case of the PAD for the whole year, I think it has to have some organic basis. Some people would want to come on their own. And in fact, for the red shirts, they find this, it further galvanizes them, right? You know, a lot of their paraphernalia, it says, damn it, I've come on my own. Not paid, on my own. So class warfare, I don't think we've reached that point yet. You know, the political science definition for a civil war is 1,000 fatalities. So we're still a long way from that. But besides the technical definition, it doesn't feel that way yet. But if these people, and I say that, you know, these people who have voted for these parties, which I did not vote for, but if their parties keep getting dissolved, you know, and then they're not brought into the fold, and they're alienated and marginalized, like they're just a gullible, payable mob, I'm just afraid that they'll keep coming back. Yeah.
Question. Thank you for all your comments. My name is Anthony Wood. I'm not a journalist. I have a house in Bangkok, married to a Thai. Just a couple of points. Firstly, the support for the red shirts is much more widespread than just the Northeast. Certainly, vast number of people I speak to in urban Bangkok that are, if you like, in the working classes, virtually 100% of them support the red shirts. And it is also a fact that I know many of the street or small business Thai, small business people here in Hong Kong are sending money to the red shirts. I also understand that there's a split within certain elements of the royal family between reds and yellows. There's a split within the army between reds and yellows. But I just wonder if there's any possibility of any of the only other institution in Thailand, which is namely the monkhood, the Buddhist monkhood, acting as a sort of a stable institutional interlocutor in the strifes that are going to come ahead. Mm.
Before I came here, I was just tuning into the, you know, you can tune in from Hong Kong, outside Thailand, to all the red and yellow channels, right? But in Bangkok, it's blocked. But on the red channel, there was a monk calling for farmers to come to Bangkok. So the Buddhist monkhood may not be the interlocutor that we need. The scope of the Reds, yes, in Bangkok, if you look at the numbers, number of MPs, in Bangkok, they would have about 9% of the electorate, 36 out of 400. If you look at the household registrations, 6 million are registered to domicile in Bangkok, right? But in fact, the consensus is that there's 9 to 10 million, 8.5 to 10 million, let's say, who actually live in Bangkok. So the addition, the margin, is from the countryside, many from the Northeast, who work in the hotels, the golf courses, and so on and so on, the restaurants. So and then they're being complemented now by the Karens. So there's a Bangkok underclass, the Bangkok people who come from the countryside. They're the ones who join the evening. And yes, it's logical because they come from the Northeast. A lot of taxi drivers from the Northeast, typically 9 out of 10 taxi drivers would be pro-red, and they would have a role, they want to play a role. So that's where the divide is, the disparity and the polarization. Few, I mean, would be not a significant number from the Bangkokians, the Bangkok middle class, would be red. In fact, it would be the other, the multicolors, the pink and yellow and so on.
Yeah. We're actually just running over time, but if you've got a really quick question, please.
My name's Gilam Tulloch. I work for an economics outfit called Asianomics, although I'm not an economist. I just have a question. If this is a battle over control of the state, why not reduce the size of the state and decentralize it, in which case there's nothing really to fight over?
Decentralize or devolve, there is some of that. But, you know, this is really, I'm afraid the question is a little bit moot. Because it's so Bangkok-centered. To do that, yeah, you have to get over this crisis first. If they can get over this crisis, have a new consensus, they can have agreements to devolve authority and power away from Bangkok, away from the Interior Ministry. Thaksin did a little bit of that. He reorganized the ministries from 14 to 20. And the Constitution of 1997 mandates decentralization. But Bangkok is all-consuming. Right, all-consuming. And decentralization would also undermine the existing structure of the state. For example, if you have direct elections of provincial governors, so you have people in the provinces electing their own people, and maybe fiscal decentralization, so the local taxes go for local needs and doesn't have to all come to Bangkok and go back again. Well, that would deprive the power, the traditional power of the Bangkok-centered institutions and agencies and elites, and they won't let that happen.
Well, Dr. Tittinan, thank you very much. It's always a wonderful thing to come to lunches like this where you leave knowing a lot more than you did when you came in. So just before you go, I want to present you with a priceless FCC gift. It's wrapped in yellow paper. You can remove that. Thank you very much.